Good morning, everyone. Last night, I was sharing about this idea of the two arms of the practice. The first arm taking care of suffering, and the second arm nourishing our happiness, our joy. And the idea with that is that it's a simple construct for helping us to then apply our practice in the various moments and activities of our daily life. So I also shared the four establishments of mindfulness, bringing our awareness deeply into the experience of the body, a feeling, a thinking, and then in relationship to all kinds of people and places and situations, the world, to life. Again, it's another construct, a mental construct, like a model, a theoretical model. But the intention is not just to grasp and understand something, but to give us a framework that helps us to navigate, to actually practice, to actually embody and live into ourselves and this experience we're having with more clarity and more depth. I'd like to begin this talk, this session, with a short guided meditation. And this is a meditation that basically takes those four establishments of mindfulness and works them into a sitting meditation. Right? It's very simple. If you're like me, I like visualization. I have a very imaginative mind that goes all over the place and creates really amazing and wonderful things somewhere. And sometimes I can use that capacity to help ground me, actually, instead of lose myself. And I was talking yesterday about these concentric circles of the four establishments of mindfulness. That's a way for me to visualize these layers of practice. And so as we do this guided meditation, you might try that, if that works for you, as each layer that we go through draws us, in terms of that image, further into the center, closer into the center of our experience. When we sit, it's really helpful if we are comfortable. There's three words that we use a lot in the Plum Village tradition. The first is upright, the second is stable, and the third is relaxed. And so if all three of those are happening, that's awesome. And if one of them's not, make an adjustment and see what you can find for support to enable all three of those qualities to be present in the sitting position, the sitting position of the body. Sitting like I'm sitting, which is not really a lotus or half lotus, but with my legs slightly folded in front of me, I have triangulation. And three points on the earth, like a tripod or more, creates a solid center. Two, you can fall easily in one direction. One, you can fall in any direction. But three gives you that sense of center. And if your body allows, or if you need cushions or a chair or something to create that sense of triangulation or more, then that's fine. We just make sure that that happens. That allows us to be stable. And then we can, in that stability, also have our uprightness. Hmm. The uprightness helps us to be bright, to be alert. We can meditate lying down horizontally, but it's easy to drift away in that position, and not just in sleep, but to wander inside. The upright posture of the body mirrors the inspiration in us to remain alert and awake in our inner life, our mind, our intention, right? But if we hold ourselves upright with tension, then we will spend our time in sitting meditation struggling instead of being present with the full experience. We will be fighting the experience that we're having, struggling to maintain it. And so that's why we say relaxed. So upright, stable, and relaxed. Sometimes that means having something to lean back against, right? And sometimes it's fine not to. And in this style of guided meditation, there are leading thoughts, guiding thoughts that accompany the in-breath and the out-breath. It's very difficult for us to turn our mind off and just to have no thinking at all. In fact, very, very, very few of us can do that. Right? And it usually takes a lot of training. So instead of struggling not to think or not to have something going on in our mind, we give our mind something beautiful to do, something wonderful to do, to help us stay present. And that's the idea with the leading thought, the guiding thought. So the simplest one that you hear a lot in Plum Village style practice is, while I'm breathing in, I'm aware that I'm breathing in. And while I'm breathing out, I'm aware that I'm breathing out. And that's a thought, right? This is something we can actually say inside to ourselves. While I'm breathing in, well, we don't necessarily say that part, but it's like while the in-breath is happening, we say, I am breathing in. And while the out-breath is happening, we say, I am breathing out to ourselves. And in that way, our mind starts to come together with the activity of our body, which is already quite natural. Our breath is going to move in and out anyway, on its own. We don't have to do anything except make the fine effort of following the breath as it moves in. And so the mind is doing that. It's following that and following it out. And if you do that for a while, you don't necessarily need to say the whole sentence, I am breathing in. While you're breathing in, you can just say in and out, in and out. Or like the song we just sang, calm, ease, right? These are words that are brought in to accompany the in-breath and the out-breath. Smile, release, right? Those are condensations of larger intentions, longer thoughts. And so you condense it down to, simplify it down to one or two words. And then your mind doesn't have to be doing so much thinking about what you're doing. It's just a small thought of this. And if you're able, at a certain point, you can just drop the words altogether and simply breathe. And breathe out. But again, that takes a lot of practice. So don't worry if that's not working for you. Use the sentences if they help you to stay present. Our mind wants to do something, and it has a capacity to do something. Right? And here we are learning how not to think mindlessly, so to speak, but not without any sense of agency in our thinking, where it just wanders here and there and drags us along with it. Here we are learning how to be the thinker, right? And to enter into the thinking process with clarity and with intention, with freedom. So that's kind of how these thoughts progress. That's the structure of the way the guided meditation works. And so for 3 or 4 minutes normally, you would have a particular guiding thought that you carry for that 3 or 4 minutes, like breathing in, I know I'm breathing in, breathing out, I know I'm breathing out. And then after a few minutes, another thought is introduced for the next step of the guided meditation, and so on like that. If these things work to help you stay in your practice and deepen the experience of the moment, wonderful. If they don't, do something else. I like to say that every meditation is actually a guided meditation. Just who's guiding is the question, right? And is it your habit energy? Is it someone offering it with a microphone? Is it, right? Is it you yourself, right? We are always deciding something there. We're always guiding some process. This one, we're going to do shorter versions, maybe 1 minute or so of quiet breathing with each one, because I have more to say. So please find that upright, stable, relaxed way of being in your body and begin to notice the in-breath moving in and out. The position of the body revealed by awareness coming into it. Here's where it is. Here's where I'm sitting. Here's the contact with the cushion, with the floor. Here's the sensation of the air moving in the nose, the throat, the lungs. And become aware of the whole body of the breath, the space that it takes up. Breathing in, I'm aware of my whole in-breath. And breathing out, aware of my whole out-breath. In-breath, out-breath. And as you continue to breathe, allow awareness to expand beyond the body of the breath to fill up the whole physical body. As if there were a candle's flame in the belly, radiating out and its light touching every cell in the whole body. While breathing in, I am aware of my whole body. While breathing out, I invite my whole body to relax. Aware of body. Relaxing body. Body. Relaxing. Continuing to be aware of the in-breath and out-breath, I allow my awareness to soften into the experience of feeling, of sensing. Feeling and sensing within and a little bit around the body. And I become aware of sensation, feeling, and keep my awareness with the sensation and feeling as if I were tending to a small child, taking care of the small child. Being presence, being present with spaciousness. with ease. While breathing in, I am aware of feeling. And while breathing out, I invite my feeling to calm. Aware of feeling, calming feeling. Feeling, calming. As I continue to breathe in and out, I draw my awareness inwards still further to the experience of thoughts arising within me, my mind and its thinking, my thoughts reaching out from within me to understand. And I see thoughts arising in me, and I observe them just as if I were watching clouds in the sky, turning, moving, and dissipating. While breathing in, I'm aware of thoughts arising. And while breathing out, I release those thoughts, I let them go. Aware of thoughts, releasing thoughts. Thoughts, releasing. Now, having brought awareness to my body and brought awareness to feeling, having brought awareness to my mind, I draw myself inwards to the center point of awareness itself. And I am aware of life in this moment revealing itself within me and all around me. My awareness is like a sun shining indiscriminately on all things. While breathing in, I am aware of life within and around me. While breathing out, I smile to life. Aware of life within and around, smiling to life. Life, smiling. And let us listen to the sound of a bell. It's so easy when we are able to really come home to ourselves to soften the edges, walls, boundaries we've put around our heart and feel, embody the true connection that we have to life and to each other. To experience our interbeing nature. I think for many of us lately, there have been a lot of things going on. I don't know how else to say it. There's a lot going on. And it's going on in our homes and in our families, and it's going on in our cities and towns. It's going on all around the world. And because of the way that we are living in our modern society, we are hyper aware, we are super aware of so many different stories, so many different events, so many different things that are happening. And so we are, if we're going to open ourselves to that kind of information, right, we have to expect that there will be some effect. And for me, to summarize that, is that it's really easy to be overwhelmed. To be overwhelmed in many ways. Be overwhelmed by busyness, so many things to take care of, and the pace of it all. To be overwhelmed by the emotional intensity of so many sufferings, so much stimulation. To be overwhelmed by the stimulation. Our systems have not evolved in time with the amount of input that we receive nowadays. We're not actually wired for all this yet. Maybe, you know, another 50,000 years. And we will evolve the capacity to operate at the levels of stress that we are currently exposing ourselves to. Do you feel good when you walk outside? Like, and you take a breath of fresh air, and you look at a tree or a mountain or the lake? It's healing instantly, right? Our Mother Earth, she moves at a very different pace from our modern life. She has rhythms and cycles that have evolved and been tested by time, and they're very stable, very strong. And actually, these things are not like nature out there. This is our nature. We call it nature. It's our nature. I'm not playing with words, right? It's our nature. We also move and flow in the same rhythms and cycles as our Mother Earth does. For me, that's kind of explains why I feel good when I walk outside, when I lean against a tree, when I sit in the grass, when I feel the cold water flowing over my hands from the mountain stream, you know? This is a really awesome time to be outside. You notice so many brilliant changes, right? When I flew in the other day into Missoula, it was late in the day, So the sun was getting low, and always the light when it comes across the surface of the earth like that, it adds so much color and depth, and it makes things really awesome. So I was looking out the window. I always take window seats. I was looking out the window as we were starting to make our descent, and I thought I was seeing some visual, illusion of like refracting light or something, because I was seeing these huge, soft rainbow colors everywhere. And I was like, it must be from the, you know, the way the light is reflecting, or maybe off the glass of the window. And I kept looking at it, and it was the colors in the hills right now. These, as some of the plants are coming into their color, their bloom, it's so beautiful and so amazing to see that. And this is a time of year when you can see wonders like that. The transformation becomes really visible. Of course, things are changing all year round, but we really notice it in certain moments, and the spring is one of these moments where you just see this life erupting out of winter sleep. And it's so wonderful, the turning of the seasons. The turning of the seasons is like Mother Earth's breath in and out, right? This filling up with life energy and blossoming out and flourishing through the summer, and then letting go and fading, at least in a hemisphere that we're in, right? In the northern hemisphere, we experience this. And that letting go in fall as things settle back down, the out-breath to the rest and the still point in winter, and then turning, right? She's our natural timekeeper for us. We don't need a watch. Yeah, we don't need that machination. We have it. Yeah, it's there. It's a part of who we are. It's what we come from. It's where we go. So Mother Earth is like our Sangha. She's breathing with us all the time, supporting us in our practice all the time. There for us to lean on, to cry with, to celebrate with. Please don't go too far from your nature. Yeah. If we become too estranged from that, we will suffer a lot. We know this. We do it. Our Mother Earth gives us so much support. She also teaches us. She's very wise. She teaches us a lot. One of my favorite teachings is evident to me when I do go outside, say into the forest, and if you ask a forester about a healthy forest, they will not tell you. They will tell you that the forest, which has had, you know, looks all clean, and all the trees are this big, tall, beautiful ones, and there's like lots of space to sit underneath on the ground, and all that's all been cleared up and made beautiful, like a park. Like, it's not actually very healthy as a forest. A healthy forest is going to have fallen, broken limbs everywhere. It also has the process of the decay as part of its life, right? Back east is more humid. We have a lot more rain, wet. So, and when I go out, there's like rotting soft mosses and lichens everywhere. And in a healthy part of the forest, you can smell it, right? It's like this is the smell of rich, fertile life happening. But this is like everything that's dying and falling apart. It's all the compost and the dirt and the stuff we normally push away. So there's a teaching in here, there's a wisdom in here about having a beautiful relationship with the hard parts of our life and also the easy parts of our life, the suffering that's in us and our joy, and sort of like that flourishing but also the decay. And for some reason we tend to resist this stuff, like, you know, we don't want that decay. Sometimes it hurts. Often it does. We don't want that stuff which is smelly. We push it away. We don't want that stuff which is difficult. And I'm not saying we have to make it and go out and agitate for a lot of suffering. One time when I was a monk, we have these monastic retreats where we would just have retreats for the monks and nuns with the teacher, with Thich Nhat Hanh, with Thay. And he would do a lot of questions and answer sessions for us in those moments. And at that particular point in my practice, I was working with this idea of suffering and happiness, and in particular the idea of attachment. And I was like, what's wrong with attachment, right? It's like food for growth and learning. And I asked Thay that question. And he looked at me and he said, there's enough suffering in the world already. You don't need to go make more. So I'm not advocating for going to make more suffering. But the suffering that is present in our lives isn't necessarily something we want to get rid of. Just like the forest won't be very healthy if it gets rid of all of the dead, dying parts of itself. All the parts that are falling away that would seem to be waste products or unwanted. They're actually a very important nutrient for the whole ecosystem. Yeah. On a trip in China, a teaching tour with Thay once, we were in a huge temple, like beautifully painted, and all these carved statues and posts and beams and pillars and everything. It's all ornate and beautiful, and these tiled, smooth tiled marble-like floors everywhere. It was very grand. And Thay was giving a Dharma talk to the monks who lived and practiced there. And he came out at one point, and he was talking about this experience of suffering and its relationship with happiness, and having not discriminating one against the other, which is what I'm kind of talking about here, Mother Earth sharing this part of herself with us. That he said, lotuses don't grow on marble. The lotus flower is the symbol of awakening in Buddhism, right? It's this incredibly fragrant, beautiful flower, but it grows in the mud. It doesn't grow anywhere else. It needs a lot of thick, gooey mud, muck, right, for it to grow. That's how it lives. And he came out very boldly, lotuses don't grow on marble. And several layers of teaching there in that moment. Yeah, we have compost. We have a way of cultivating. We can have a way of cultivating rich nutrient for beautiful flowers, right? And this is a gardening image, a natural Mother Earth kind of image. But it's also our can be our way of holding the difficult, the hard, the suffering moments in us, to not want necessarily to run away from them. Of course, that doesn't mean just stand in front of the elephant and let yourself get trampled, right? It's we do want to protect ourselves, but the suffering which is already in us, which is there, right? We don't want to discard it, because in there is a lesson, something beautiful in there, a nutrient that, given the right conditions, can blossom. Have any of you ever kept a compost pile? Right? Oh, look at that. Yeah, so look at them preaching to the choir. So we have when you keep a compost pile, you can just throw things on the ground and let them rot, right? But that's not really keeping a compost pile. That's throwing things on the ground and letting them rot. But if you keep a compost pile, you take care of it. You layer different ingredients in, right? You turn it from time to time. I've had compost piles where I put my hand in and it was so hot it burned. There's billions of microorganisms in there having a party. And it was just the right conditions for that breaking down and turning into something new to happen, right? And our practice can help us, right, to rework our relationship with hardship, with difficulty, with suffering, so that it becomes a kind of compost for our new learning, our new growth. Mud and lotus, compost and rose. It's a kind of non-discriminative love, right, that we are going to cultivate. So there's something that needs to be said here, which is about a whole shift in lifestyle. And if you don't want to go through this shift, you probably shouldn't go very far with this practice. But it's no longer about pleasure seeking. This practice doesn't take you down the road of pleasure seeking. Our society is all about pleasure seeking, right? We do so much of it. So much of it. We'd much rather have something really tasty to eat or something entertaining to watch than like sit still and take care of what needs to be taken care of inside, right? We do a lot of avoiding and covering up of our suffering. So no more seeking after pleasure. It doesn't mean life can't be pleasurable, but we're not looking to the pleasure to give us our energy, to give us our sense of meaning and purpose, to give us our comfort for happiness. The pleasures of our world are very real and very lovely, but they're also fleeting. And if we put our money on that, well, yeah, maybe it'll be there, maybe it won't. So there's another place that we turn for that sense of meaning, for that sense of well-being. And it's into this process of living deeply, of living fully, wholly. Both arms of the practice, right? I'm going to take care of my suffering and take care of my joy. So no more pleasure seeking, more like soul fulfilling. I'm going to sing you a song, if I can remember it. This is a song that comes out of practicing with this, renewing this relationship to my heart when it was aching.
Lord, now my eyes are crying tears. Oh, so forgiving. Lord, now I am not hiding here in the things that had once weighed so heavy on my soul.
my tender soul. Seeing with your eyes, gifted me by lives, spent so gently stripping the vestment of my pride. Hearing with your ears, opened over years, waking generations from the slumber of these fears. Walking in your footsteps, shown me whilst desire slept. Tenderly embraced, O blood and spirit, weaving time through space, in the very heart of me. Lord, now my eyes are crying tears. O so forgiving. Lord, now I am not hiding here in the things that had once weighed so heavy on my soul, the soft petals of my soul. So I wrote that song a long time ago when I was learning about this practice of being present with my suffering. And one of the ways that this manifests is learning how to be with strong emotional experiences and not to be dragged around, pulled around. As a victim of our strong emotions, but instead learning how to experience them just as they are. There's a lot of different levels to that practice. An emotion to me, as I was sharing with you before about feeling and sensation, this is not the same as an emotion, right? Feeling and sensation are sensations, feelings. An emotional experience is something that involves all different layers of our being. In fact, it involves all the four layers of the establishments of mindfulness, which are really an image of the human experience. Because our emotions have a lot to do with the people around us, the world around us. Our emotions have a lot to do with the way we're thinking about things. There's definitely a felt experience, a sensing experience. And we also, it comes right down into our physical organism. So our emotional experience is all of it, right? So when something takes over, right, although it's on all the levels of our being, we tend to get stuck in a particular place, in a strong emotional moment. We're caught inside ourselves. Especially when we feel any kind of sense of danger or threat, we actually close off, right? We shut down. We lose our capacity to empathize, to connect. We close down into ourselves. And so learning to be with our strong emotional experiences is also learning to stay in a space of connection and empathy, connection with life, and being able to sense and feel and relate with the world around us. Mm-hmm. Kai had this wonderful way of talking about being with strong emotions, as if to treat our strong emotions as if we were being with a child that is suffering, a child that is crying, a little child that's crying, like a baby that's crying. When they start to cry, you go to the child and you pick it up and you hold it and you let it know that it's okay, even if you don't know what's wrong. You still give it that sense of like, I've got you, it's okay. You take it in your arms and you embrace it, right? You make yourself fully present for it. And there are parts of ourselves when we're hurting, our emotional experience, the strong emotion comes up. If we can learn to come to our emotional experience, right? Not be inside it, pulled around by it, but be aware that it's happening and bring other parts of ourselves to it to embrace it, then we have an opportunity to transform that experience. Hopefully in a beautiful direction. When I do that practice, I actually like to use my arms and gently embrace myself. Sometimes it's very clear where in my body this emotion is resonating, and I can just go there with my hands and bring some attention to that space. Other times I'm just overwhelmed and I need that hug, right, in a way. But I'm aware that the emotion has arisen in me, and I'm coming to it with my practice. So there's a little bit of determination here, right? I have to first know that I'm suffering, that something's come up, and then also be clear that I don't want to just go along with it in the way it usually goes. I know where it goes. Yeah. The seeds in our consciousness, they have their tendencies and they stick to them. Apples don't grow oranges, right? Apple tree won't produce oranges. An apple tree will produce more apples. And that seed of frustration and anger in me is not going to produce peace in the world or in myself if I just allow it to grow. It will produce more of itself. So I need to bring something else there. I need to companion plant a little bit and bring an embrace of a different kind of energy so that they can meet and begin to change each other. So I bring my mindfulness, which is, I am aware that I am suffering. I am aware that something's come up, that I feel this pain. And now I'm going to bring my awareness to hold it. I might even talk to myself while I do it. Because my mind needs a different story to tell, and that's another important part of this practice. We can't keep telling ourselves the story of the agitation and the fear, the anxiety. If we keep repeating those thoughts over and over again, of course we're going to experience what they mean. We have to bring a new story in. And this story is, I know that I'm hurting and I want to take care of me. I've got you now, Michael. Gotcha. Just like that little baby. We're gonna figure out what's going on. I gotcha. There's also the practice which can be really helpful, which is to help bring us out of that agitation, that's part of the emotional experience, which is the story, the righteousness, the anger, why me, all these stories inside that might be in there. We bring the energy down in our body. You can put your hand on your belly and practice belly breathing. You can do this in a business meeting too. If somebody's across the table said something that really touches that seed of suffering inside, you can say, okay, now's not the time to go into this and figure this out. So I've got to bring myself into my center and hold this place of me, which is hurt. It's already hurt. Those words just touched the hurt, right? It's sprung up. Let's not get agitated. Let's not get carried away. Bring your hand to your belly, and you breathe down the energy down towards your belly, right? Or if that's not, if being embodied like that is not your thing, it doesn't work for you, you can imagine yourself like one of these mountains. A deep base of rock and stone, this wide base, and feel the solidity of the mountain, right? You bring your energy down out of the head and breathe a few times in that embrace. And if we can do this just for 3-5 breaths, which is like what, 20, 30, 40 seconds, we can change the experience of the emotion already. It may not make it go away, and we don't need it to go away. It's nice if it does, but we don't need it to. What it does is it lessens the urgency, and it creates a relationship with rather than being dragged around by. So instead of a victim of the experience, it's the way I'm experiencing it when I'm inside the emotion. This is happening to me. Now I'm in relationship with it. I'm a participant. And that's an entirely different experience. And it only takes a minute, right? It's so wonderful. But it is a skill we need to learn, and it's based on resources also. If I don't have mindfulness, I won't know that the emotion has come up, and I'll just be pulled around by it. So I need to be cultivating that energy of awareness in my life already for it to be available for me. What will we do the embracing with? Again, if I embrace my anger with more frustration than anger, with more agitation, with more blaming and condemning, right? It's only going to escalate. And I want to stay centered, grounded. I want to be clear and free and meeting the world from the best place in me, and not controlled by the habit energies and suffering of the past. In us, there are all kinds of different possibilities. We call them seeds, bija, potentials inside of us. And these seeds can manifest in so many different ways. And this little image is basically an image for what I've been talking about. In our daily life, somehow a seed of strong emotion, of suffering, has been watered. The conditions are right for it. And it springs up in here. And it begins to take over the landscape of my conscious life, my day-to-day life. You all know this. So it takes over that space. And the practice of mindfulness, if it's a part of my life, is like a little plant hanging out over here, just watching. While I'm walking, I know I'm walking. While I'm eating my food, I know I'm eating my food. Right, and so on, through the day, I've been cultivating a little awareness, so my awareness is part of my daily life. And because that's there, I know that a strong emotion has arisen in me. And I feel a lot of suffering inside. But because I see it, I now can bring something to it. Yeah. So I call on my mindfulness and my loving kindness. That's the part of me which wants to take care. My strength and determination to not go down the road of suffering anymore. I don't want to go down the road of suffering anymore. I've done this so many times. I don't want to keep reacting like this. I want to learn another place, another skill, another capacity in me. So I'm going to change direction. And I call on all that strength and that determination, the loving kindness, just bring it up from this place where it is inside of me to reach up and embrace the suffering. Now in my life, my moment of life, as I breathe the embrace, the energy of my kindness, my compassion, my strength, my mindfulness is connecting with the energy of hurt and anguish and anger or suffering in me. They're becoming each other a little bit. And as I breathe for a minute or two or three and the whole thing, the urgency settles down, things settle down, this experience of suffering now goes back into my unconscious, right? With the print of my practice upon it. This is the same event as, you know, last year when we went fishing and I caught that fish and it was this big. Oh yeah, did you hear about the fish I caught that was this big? And it was this big. And our memory, unfortunately, is not a clear thing. Every time that we recall something out of store consciousness, our unconscious space, every time we bring up something, the context that we bring it up in becomes a part of it. And so, in terms of like telling stories from the past, how they become more and more elaborate or exaggerated, or right? After a few rounds of that, you actually don't know what the original event was anymore. We don't know anymore what happened before because we've told it in so many contexts. It has shifted and changed. That's kind of scary, but it's also really awesome because it allows us to transform the past right here in this present moment. And in this case, suffering of the past has come up from inside of me. It's taken over my moment as a strong emotional experience, but I'm embracing it. So the context of this recollection is the embrace of mindfulness, understanding, spaciousness, and that print goes in. So the next time that seed of suffering is touched in me, it comes up with the print of my practice in it. It's a little bit transformed. And again and again and again and again, right, I learn how to be present with these sorts of strong experiences because the practice becomes more and more a part of that. That arising of the seed of suffering in me is now part of, filled with the energy of my practice. I learn how to do it. Tai would say, we learn how, if you know how to suffer well, then you suffer less. One of the things that I really love to do when I'm holding difficult experiences is to invite the support and the strength of my interbeing nature to help me. Because often when I'm suffering, I feel like I'm all alone. I sometimes also feel like I'm really important. And in my suffering, somehow that happens. I'm going to give you an example, okay? So when your teenage child says something to you, like, I hate you, you're the worst parent ever. and that experience happens, right? I hate you, you're the worst parent ever. And you're like, yeah, I'm giving my entire life and all my energy to support you. How is this happening? But there's a place in me that hears that and goes, you don't talk to your parents like that. And I want to shut them down, right? And it's an old habit energy, a transmission from, you know, ancestors coming through. And even if I really don't want to have that kind of reaction to my child, that reactivity comes up in me, right? But I feel like this is the most important thing in the world, that my child understand that they are in the wrong right now and they cannot act like that, right? So my feelings are extremely important in that moment. And that's what I mean, like by the sense of importance in the emotional experience, right? You know, the other person cannot act like that. It's not right. You know, where does that come from, right? We don't know where that comes from. It's old. It's old. Well, so that happens. Oh. There are So that's a transmission from ancestors of painful, suffering habit energy. I also have transmissions in me of real patience and love and kindness, of compassion and understanding. And I like to call on them in those moments. It's only fair, right? If like the ancestor's suffering is coming in, why can't the ancestor's joy also be there? So I want to call on those parts of me that are also resting in here in this store consciousness, this unconscious space. I want to call on them to be present also and help me with that embrace. So it's not just my patience and my loving kindness and my conscious breathing, but it's that of my teachers and the people whom I've leaned on for support. Maybe my Sangha. So I invite my spiritual ancestors to help me hold suffering. Inside myself, I tell myself that story. Because it's real, they are here. You can't take them out of you, right? You have learned these ways of being, these ways of walking, these ways of breathing, these ways of thinking beautiful thoughts, of loving love, of loving insight. Of what I mean is that, like, I love love. I love insight, right? I really value these things, and they're in me, and they've been transmitted to me by those who have come before. Some of them may have come from my mother and father, may have come from my ancestors on the blood side, but also through all the teachers that I've learned from and the spiritual traditions that I've been a part of. It's within me also, and I call on them to help me hold that difficult moment. Breathe with me. Help me do this. Sometimes I just say, will you please do this for me? I'm overwhelmed. They do. They help out. They jump in all the time. Tai? Well, I have a picture of Tai up here. Is there a picture of Tai around? It's over there. Yeah. Tai, my teacher, is very much a part of me in that sense. And I often ask Tai to do it for me. Sometimes when I'm inviting the bell, I do not feel like I've got body, speech, and mind in perfect oneness. But I have to invite the bell anyway. So as I say to myself, body, speech, and mind in perfect oneness, Tai, will you please invite for me? Thank you. And I ask Tai to do the bell invitation because I feel unsteady and need to let my ancestors' steadiness come through. Yeah. We can also take refuge in our Mother Earth in these moments. You can call on her to help. She's a part of every cell of your body, and she's the master of perseverance and transformation. There's no other like her. You cannot top it. The incredible manifestations and the way they transform over tens of thousands of years on this planet are just unbelievable. You can't grasp it with your mind how incredibly complex and beautiful it is. She's a master of it, and she's a part of every cell of our body, of who we are, and all of our ancestors too. So we can call on Mother Earth to help us hold in that moment. So we don't feel alone and cut off and unable or without capacity. And I sometimes, just like I like to hold myself while I'm doing this inner embrace, I create an outer embrace. Sometimes I go out when I really need to and I take a walk and I go to a tree and I wrap my arms around the tree and I hug it. And I talk to the tree and I ask the tree to help me not be so agitated, not be so overwhelmed. Like, how do you stand here for 50, 80, 100 years and just breathe in and out with the seasons and not have any mental agitation at all? It's so wonderful. And I let myself experience that vitality, that real living, breathing vitality of the tree. It does not have all this mess going on inside its brain, right? That's not happening for the tree. And so I can then regulate and return the agitation. And part of the embrace is now the presence of the forest holding me too. Running water is also really awesome for me. I grew up with streams and rivers and playing in them a lot, and it was like my place of refuge as a child. And so that sound of running water, instantly, for some people it makes them pee, for me it just makes me happy. I hear that sound and immediately I start to feel the sense of flow and ease and cleansing and healing. And that's what water does when it's moving. Right? You watch it and study it. It's cleansing itself when it moves in these lemniscate patterns, turning inwards on itself. And if you put it in space without gravity, what does it do? It becomes a beautiful sphere. It's like so cool. I love water. And so I'll go to water. I will go to a place where there's running water or moving water, and I can see that flow, that movement, and I can hear it. And it helps me realize that I'm part of a process of learning and growing, and I don't have to be stuck in this intense experience of this moment. And the water helps me hold it. Yeah, take refuge. Taking refuge in my sangha of Mother Earth, my sangha of ancestors, and literally my sangha of sisters, brothers, and siblings all around the world. We are everywhere, y'all. Everywhere. And you can go anywhere on this planet and find practitioners of a beautiful path. And we can seek each other out and walk hand in hand to help calm and steady, to understand ourselves, to listen deeply with each other. We need that. We really need it. Without discrimination, right? Without trying to get away from the hard places, the suffering parts of ourselves, but leaning into the resources we have and building them and growing them, protecting them. So as I said before, this kind of practice depends on that we have something to practice with. We talk about this as capacity, right? Having our reservoir of practice energy is full, right? We would like that to be the case, but for that to be the case, we have to do both practices. We can't just try to take care of suffering and solve all the problems. We also have to water seeds of joy and happiness and fulfillment in us. We have to take the time to be deeply nourished. It should be daily practice for us if we're going to be on a path and call ourselves practitioners. Right? It should be daily practice for us to water seeds of joy and well-being. To have moments that we set down. We set down so many moments on our schedules now. We got to set down moments in the schedule, make them important as emails and business meetings and appointments and this and that and Netflix in the evening, right? As important as that needs to be joy and watering seeds of joy, ease and releasing the stress of the day, right? Every day. When you walk outside and you see the gentle rain falling from the clouds. It actually is the clouds, right? And you go out and maybe you take away your hood or your hat or your umbrella for a moment to feel that gentle rain on your hair and on your skin. You go, oh, that's awesome. Cloud is like washing my face right now. And then you put your hood and your hat back on and you keep going, right? So that was a moment of joy, a moment of deep connection with life, a moment of beauty, nourishing, and it's gone, right? Because I was there for a couple seconds, and then I went right back into my habit energy. So the trick with our practice is to be able to turn those moments into meaningful moments, long-lasting moments. It doesn't actually take very long. In fact, the studies that are out there now are showing us that it's somewhere around 20 seconds. Believe it or not, of really staying present with an experience for it to be transferred to the place in us which is important, meaningful. Right? This should be remembered. Long-term memory. Right? This should be remembered. This experience, this moment should be remembered. When Thay has taught us the practice of listening to the bell, he didn't have the research data, but he already knew this. He says, breathe in and out for at least 3 whole breaths, listening to the sound of the bell, allowing that sound to be present in you, and allowing that moment of practice to really become something important, where you release your running, your striving, your longing, your agitation just for that 20 or 30 seconds before you start again. That transfers that experience of stopping. It makes it important. It gets marked in our neurobiology as important. So the same when we go out and we notice the rain on our face. Maybe you don't have to stay there getting soaked. You could step back, but really make sure that you take enough time to settle in and really let it, you'll feel the shift when you relax and you let go of running. And you let the beauty of that moment settle in. Now it has become a part of who you are. Nourishing the capacity for joy, you're building it inside yourself. It's become part of you. Now you have a memory, long-lasting, of the beauty and the wonder of life in a moment of rain falling on your face. Oh. There are countless moments like that in our day that we can make beautiful and important. They don't have to just be like rain and moonlight, and can be when you're sitting silently next to a stranger on the bus. But you just realize that you're the beauty of that moment, sitting on the bus, supported. Maybe you've had a little conversation and you're grateful that the person is alive and well and you're alive and well. But if you allow that to be important, right, then it is important. But if you keep running around, agitation, it's never important. It's just nice. Yeah. So we have to skillfully build our capacity for wholesomeness. We'll spend an hour or two sitting there making some show important, letting it come in and shape our thoughts and ideas and feelings about the world. Some podcast, some other thing, right? And we don't even know what's going to be said or done on it. We're just trusting in it. We need to take also some control of those moments and say, okay, I'm going to nourish myself in a way that really helps my capacity to be present, to hold, to love, to be patient, to embrace, keeps that alive. So there's nourishing our wholesomeness, and there's also protecting it. So I'm going to expand this diagram a little bit here. I did a chant this morning. Some of you are familiar with that, and maybe some not. In that chant is a rewrite of a very old sutra in Mahayana Buddhism called the Heart Sutra. And Thich Nhat Hanh, back in 2014, I believe, rewrote it. It's not just a new translation. He actually added stuff and took stuff out. It's a rewrite. I think that's important to say, because that makes it different from the Heart Sutra that many Buddhist temples will and traditions will chant over and over again. This is a whole new version of it. And it's called the insight that brings us to the other shore. And it's an insight. It's a sutra about understanding things in such a way that you are not caught in the idea of separation. So the phrase a not separate self entity appears in the sutra a lot. And one of the places it appears is when it describes something called the 18 realms of elements. That sounds complicated, doesn't it? The 18 realms of elements is actually not very complicated. It's 6 things with 3 layers to each one. And I'm telling you that because some of us are kind of new to this stuff, but it's fun. The 18 realms of elements refers to eyes, ears, nose, tongue, the body, and the mind. At six, and what the eyes, the objects that the eyes see, the sounds that the ears hear, and so on, through all the others that the things thought about for the mind, right? And then that's six more. And then there's the seeing, the hearing, the smelling, the tasting, the touching, and the thinking itself, the other six. So there's what in Buddhism is called the six sense organs, and then their objects and their activities, their actual perceptions. So that's the 18 realms of elements. Here, there's no crinkly paper. We'll use the eraser. I just wrote the first five, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body around the top here. These are like thresholds, as I said last night, into the present moment experience of life, right? Our eyes are here, and when they're open and working okay, we have a relationship to forms and colors around us through our eyes, right? So the forms and colors of the world, the present moment experience is here. It's pressing in, coming in through ears, nose, tongue, and the sensations of the body, right? So our experience of our daily life is coming into this waking consciousness, we can call the mind here. Through eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And in our daily life, it's really important that we... Whoa! I just switched tops without knowing it. These are double-ended markers. When we are talking about building capacity for our practice, we need to be very mindful of what's coming in through our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body, because it will either nourish our capacity for practice or take it away. And so in this sense, in my practice, I strive to protect my energy of mindfulness, my capacity to understand and to love. And the way we do that is you put a sentinel of mindfulness at each of these doorways. So you put a sentinel of mindfulness, not so much to like guard and keep out something. It's not like a security guard. But the sentinel of mindfulness is there to observe and help us to learn what's coming in and what is the effect of it. Does it nourish my well-being or take it away? Does it nourish my capacity for vitality, joy, for understanding and compassion? Or does it water seeds of anguish, despair, and hatred in me? Right? So what we see all day long is coming in, and it's going down one of these roads. Right? So the sentinel of mindfulness at the threshold, the gateway, the door of the eyes, helps us to understand what are we looking at, and is that helping us in our daily life, or is it taking something away? The same with the ears and what we listen to. Put a sentinel there. Listen to those sounds and notice. Remember the two arms of the practice, right? Is it helping me to take care of my suffering, or is it watering my suffering, growing it? Is it helping me to nourish my happiness, or is it taking my happiness away? Smelling, tasting, touching, consuming through the body and the foods that we eat. Think of it in many different ways. Put a sentinel of mindfulness at each of the sense doorways. And in that way, our mind will slowly be able to, will be able to understand here, as all this comes in through the mind, we'll slowly be able to understand what is nourishing and what is not. So this is a practice structure to help us protect our energy of awakening, our energy of vitality, our energy of well-being. So we also need to put a sentinel of mindfulness in our mind itself. The sixth sense, right here. Because there are a lot of things which are going to arise from below, this ground of possibilities that we call store consciousness or alaya consciousness, our unconscious space, our memory, our conditioning, our habit energies, and as I said before, like the habit energies of my ancestors, right? There's a lot of things going to press into my mind from there. And that's not the present moment experience of life. It's coming from somewhere else. It's coming from a learned, habituated, conditioned place inside. It comes up. And I need to have a sentinel of mindfulness also in my heart, in my mind, to know, oh, that habit energy arising in me now, where does that take me? Is it serving my well-being? Or is it taking it away? So the sentinel of mindfulness at this threshold here. I don't know, I'm not making an eye here. It's very important to be able to see and understand what arises from deep within us. So, when I invited you all to write a response to those three prompts before the retreat, I was talking about this kind of practice. It's like I was inviting our eyes of mindfulness, our sentinels, right, to express themselves, to share what it is that they've been learning, right, about what's the state of my suffering, and how am I nourishing my suffering in my daily life, right? The sentinel of mindfulness knows this, can help us to see that. What's the state of my happiness? Is it true, or is it pleasure seeking, right? And the sentinel of mindfulness will know this. And is there anything I'd aspire to? I'd like to develop. Do I want to grow from what I understand by looking at myself in this way? Is there anything any pathway that I see in front of me? This afternoon, I'll have a chance to start talking a little bit more about that. I wanted to say thank you to everyone who contributed. I have like this book now of really wonderful sharings from so many of you. It's so rich. I'm not quite sure how to process it. It's not what I expected we were going to do for like the Sangha exposition. It went way deeper than I thought it was going to. But it's been really, really, really neat to read. I want to thank you for taking the time before the retreat to stop and reflect. Even if you just did a couple minutes, and some of you did a couple minutes, and some of you took a long time to really settle in on it, you could tell. There's a lot of gratitude in me. I see myself in so much of what many of you shared, and I feel like there's a understanding to be grown from this experience. And so I'm going to try and shape that a little bit this afternoon, and we'll continue tomorrow as well. But not exactly sure where it's going to go. But it comes from this practice. Yeah. So I'm sharing with you like a kind of a Buddhist psychology model of what we're doing, but it's really a lot more simple than that. It's about getting in touch with ourselves and seeing what's going on, right? In a few moments, we're going to go out to practice walking meditation. I think we'll go in the rain anyway. Yep, Peggy says yep. So walking meditation is an incredible opportunity to take some of the deep sentiments and understandings of our meditation practice and sort of feel through them in a different way, integrated way, as we actually move through the landscape of the world, right? And we do it together, we go as a group, but we also have that opportunity to kind of let everything settle, but also stay with the concentration that we're building in our retreat environment. As we walk, it's faster than we did in the meditation hall this morning. We'll walk 2-3 steps during the time of your in-breath and 2-3 steps during the time of your out-breath. It's like a slow, casual pace, only it's not casual. And I point that out. I'm saying that especially to those of you who have been doing it for a long time. Because we get very used to just kind of like walking along, and it's easy to just walk and kind of space out and enjoy walking, because walking outside is so awesome. But walking meditation still keeps, you know, we're still invited to keep that fine effort of being there. So instead of just following the breath like we do when we're following our breath in sitting meditation, we're following the movement of our body, the steps that we're making, and the spatial awareness we have of people and the world around us. I like to practice some sort of a technique for a while in the beginning of the walk so that it gets me grounded and settled. And then I let go of it to just enjoy. But then I'm starting my enjoyment from a place of concentration. That's how I like to do it. So I take a technique like, while I'm making a few steps and my in-breath is happening, I'm feeling the contact I have with the earth through my foot. That's a technique, right? I feel my foot on the earth. And then it shifts to the other one. It shifts to the other one. While the in-breath is happening and while the out-breath is happening. That's a really simple grounding technique for walking. Another technique is using a poem, again, using these beautiful thoughts to help our mind stay present, like, I have arrived, I am home. And so while taking a few steps, breathing in, I have arrived, I have arrived, I have arrived, I am home, breathing out, home, home, as you walk along. And you let the meaning of those words take shape in how you feel as you walk. What is it to really arrive right here, right now? To not be running somewhere else is be at home, like put your bags down and sit down on the couch, right? You let go, you relax, and really settle in. The next line of the poem is in the here, here, now, now, now. It's not so important whether you take 2 steps or 3 steps or 4 steps. You can count them if you want, but what's most important is that we are aware that we are making steps. And we're here in them as we walk over the surface of Mother Earth, through Mother Earth, together. And then after a while, with a method, a poem like that, like the I Have Arrived song, or that technique of feeling the earth with your feet, after 5, 8, 10 minutes of that, you might release the technique and really open your senses. Right? To experience the sound of the gravel moving, a bird song, the wind, the rain, the freshness, the smile of someone walking by. Right? And let those hard edges around the heart soften a little bit more, a little bit more. To trust that the beauty and the wonder of life is something that we're worth that. We can receive that. We can let ourselves become that.